Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Every once in a while in a major criminal case, you got a side character who might not even be a person, but a handle, a username. Someone who hangs around the edges of the investigation like a ghost. And in the Brian Koberger case, that ghost has a name. Papa Roger. If you've been deep into the story from the start, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Papa Roger, an online account that appeared in the days after the murders, posting in true crime groups, sometimes with commentary that was a little too close to the truth, revealing facts nobody knew, and comments that mentioned details before they were public, and oh yeah, an avatar that looked exactly like Brian Koberger before he was arrested for the murders. From day one, Papa Roger and that mystery became a cottage industry. Was it Koberger himself? Was it a clever troll? Was it someone inside law enforcement running a baiting operation to draw the suspect out? We've heard it all. We've also seen the official line from investigators. They looked into it, found no connection, I say in air quotes, and moved on. Then you start looking at the actual paperwork, like the document Jennifer Coffendaffer posted, and you see the investigation spelled the damn handle wrong. That's not nothing. You can't even match the name exactly in a search, and you really are looking at this as the investigator. Are you really looking as hard as you think you are? What makes Papa Roger interesting isn't just the post, it's the timing. The nod to Elliot Roger, not Rogers. The tone, the overlap with what we know about Koberger's habits. This was the guy who, according to Jennifer and many others, fed on data. He deleted searches as he made them. He studied every detail, and he clearly enjoyed slipping into spaces, digital or otherwise, where he could watch and comment without revealing himself. Could an anonymous Facebook persona have been part of that? Or is it exactly what the cops say? A coincidence dressed up in hindsight. There's a lot of evidence that points to it being him. That's the tension in this part of the case, a tantalizing online mystery that might mean everything or nothing at all. And if you'd follow me long enough, you know I'm not one to let go of a dangling thread just because someone says, we've checked! Jennifer, you've also checked. You've done a lot of deep digging on this. You've gone down the rabbit hole most people didn't even know existed. Let's dive into this. Now, I know we've criticized this before. I know that, and I looked at the document that you posted online that talks about, you know, the investigation in looking into his connection. Is it that thorough? Did they thoroughly look at this? Because they even spelled it wrong. I mean, look, I'm a podcaster, so I know I've spelled it wrong, but I'm a podcaster. I'm not the one investigating the actual crime itself. So if you're spelling the damn name of the character wrong in your actual investigation, I'm going to say maybe you're not looking close enough.
Well, I do always tease, you know, Twitter and social media. It's an opportunity for people to not have to worry about spelling. They don't have to worry about grammar. You just need to get your message across.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's not a police report, but these are police reports.
Yes.
And in police reports, to your point, you shouldn't be wrong, because it should be very thorough. You know, relook at it. I was very meticulous on police reports, and because just this reason, and I saw an agent have to absolutely be humiliated on the stand mm-hmm. about grammar and about spelling and about getting something else wrong. And I said, okay, yeah, I don't want that to ever be me. Mm-hmm. And so we expect police reports to be pretty spot on. Now, it was just one S, but it's still a big deal, because again, Papa Roger after, you know, Elliot mm-hmm. Roger. I mean, that was the whole idea behind it, right? The incel. Yeah. And believe me, I don't think I believe he was an incel, mm-hmm. but I don't think that drove what he did.
Just out of the practicing sense of commiserating with others on online forums.
Right.
Yeah.
And so anyway, you know, all we can do is trust mm-hmm. that they properly investigated it. But I had to throw up that picture again, because, you know, we all considered it a pretty viable possibility. And obviously law enforcement did too.
It looks just like him. And they didn't know who he was at the time. And this character knew things that were not released to the public. So either it is law enforcement. I know I've heard that theory too. Let me throw that out for a second. There was law enforcement trying to get him to come out, because they already knew who he was and they already knew what he looked like, but they were just going to throw that out there and maybe we're going to get the weasel out of the hole. Any any validity to that, or does that really not make a whole lot of sense once it's added up?
It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It really doesn't. Tony, I think that it was a sleuth that was living, eating and breathing this case. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to believe it, but I've seen some really good sleuths that get down a path and they're right.
That happened to have the same profile image as the killer before the killer is even suspected.
No. Hey, listen, anybody who followed this case and followed the Papa Roger knows I was a big one that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, every day for a long time, I posted about, wow, look at what he said today.
That's why I don't buy that it's not him. I'm like, okay, they determined it's my question was, well, how thoroughly was this investigated? And I see this report, this incident number that you've posted and the sheet. It was an officer Vargas, MPD, which I'm assuming would mean Moscow Police Department. Correct me if I'm wrong. This is not an FBI document here. This is a local This is a local department that did this.
Yes.
Probably somewhat limited on their searches when it says, I did not find the above terms related to Koberger in the accounts listed below, and it lists all the different iCloud, Snapchats, and everybody's things. But, I mean, are they operating with just the same stuff we would be too if we looked through them at that moment in time?
No, they, you know, this is the thing. They had to have found the IP mm-hmm. that was used related. And I know there's
VPN.
I knew you were going to say that. There are. And the whole thing is fascinating. I'll always be fascinated with it. I ran down so many rabbit holes, really focusing on the two posts that he did that made absolutely no sense. You know, one I think was about politics in California. The other one was about a school board. And I literally called that school, mm-hmm. talked to a board member, just really looked at who would have possibly written a post like that.
Yeah.
And none of the people I talked to posted about Papa Roger that were part of that whole school board posting, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. I ran that. I spent way too long on that. because I'm thinking, who would even know about this school board election or be angry about it or be upset? So I reached out. You know, who's involved with the school board that could possibly also be involved in this? And then there was the California political thing, as I recall. So there were two odd ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the VPN, believe me, I wish I had the tools that the FBI had
mm-hmm.
To really research this thoroughly, because it will always bother me that
yeah.
you know, this person was able to just get lucky. Boy, were they lucky.
Well, it feels like they just put the stop sign up and like the road closed here once they saw, well, the IP doesn't match to his apartment or where any place that he would have been. It's not the end of the story with a VPN. And unfortunately, it can be in terms of where you're going to investigate this, because you're never going to figure out where that came from. That's the point of a VPN. But to me, it almost points to it. That is as evident to me that it's him as it is that he turned his phone off during the actual killings. If the IP doesn't go anywhere near him and it's information and it's his damn picture, I'm sorry, it's him. Without the picture, if it was just a picture, I would be completely with the investigator saying that's not him. It's just somebody that guessed some weird shit and it turned out to be. I'm sorry, the picture just gets it for me all the time. That's what sells it. It's him. You're never going to prove that it's not, unless somebody comes out going, "It's look how lucky I was. Turned out that picture I made looked just like him." I don't know. I think the odds are slim to nil on that one.
It makes no sense. And remember really quick, there were other postings after the arrest.
Yeah.
Right. And so a lot of people see there's these other postings.
But was
he in cahoots?
But was that him? Because when people say it was Papa Rogers, we look, well, do you have the actual... you know, the actual username itself, or was this another person who popped up with Papa Rogers? Because there was a lot of fake ones that came out too. And can we confirm it was the original one? I mean, there's a lot of gray areas there too, where we just don't have the data because it wasn't necessarily archived at the time correctly, where we can find all that. And if somebody has that data to prove it better, I'm all ears. I also don't think it's crazy to think that he might have just found some weird shit to post on and posted on it, like he was very into it, like a school board meeting, to try and throw people off a little bit. Because, you know, he did have some strategery going on here. Wasn't the greatest at it, but there did seem to be some moments of, you know, enlightenment that seemed to work out well. Maybe that was one of them. I don't know. I just still have too many questions. What Jennifer lays out here is the perfect example of why this case still lives in the gray. On paper, the official line is clear. Papa Roger wasn't Koberger. But when you strip away the press release language and look at the bones of the investigation, the edges start to fray. A misspelled username in an official search. The document that says it's not him. You didn't even spell it right. Look, not trying to rag on your investigation, but I'm just saying you should have looked a little harder. Because the IP didn't match, that's a VPN. He knew how to hide his digital footprints. I don't know how you argue that the picture of him and knowing information no one else knew could possibly be somebody else. In reality, that's just not possible. A local agency handling it instead of a federal cyber team is where we got that conclusion. A conclusion that seems to rest in the absence of an IP match, as if a VPN isn't something any half-serious online user knows how to deploy. None of that is proof, but it does make you wonder how deep we checked really went. And considering this thing was going up to, like, trial about a week before he confessed, I'm kind of shocked there wasn't deeper digging on this. Then there's a human side of it. People forget how strange the early days of this case were. Before there was a suspect, Papa Roger's posts were dissected like tea leaves, and after the arrest, suddenly there was other Papa Roger popping up, trying to ride the waves, muddying the waters. Which account was the original? Which posts were legit? By the time you're three layers deep in fakes and duplicates, the digital trail starts to look like the Hall of Mirrors. And that's where this conversation really lands, in the uncomfortable space between what's technically resolved and what still doesn't sit right. Could Koberger have been Papa Roger? Sure. Could it have been an obsessed sleuth with a knack for picking up on non-public details and identifying the killer psychologically, telepathically, and creating a persona that just happens to look exactly like Brian Koberger? No. I'm just going to say no, it couldn't have been. Because that's not logical. Is it possible? I'm going to go with no, too. No. How would you know what the killer looks like? How would you have inside details of the crime if you weren't the killer? Or law enforcement, which at the time, according to them, they still did not know who Brian Koberger was. So who does that leave who knows what he looks like? Who knows that he killed four people? Who seems to be following in the footsteps of every other serial killer in the past? I think that's Brian Koberger. So could it have been both? Koberger over here, somebody over there? No. I just don't think so. I don't know that stranger things have happened. I don't know you could get something that strange to happen. It's a messy case. But it's one that doesn't involve psychic powers. What sticks with me is Jennifer's point about thoroughness. In a case where this kind of public heat, you expect the digital legwork to be airtight, not because every lead will pan out, but because it should be obvious that it was chased to the end. When you see loose threads like this left kind of hanging.
It's a VPN. We don't know.
It doesn't undo the main case, but it does leave you with the sense that maybe, just maybe, one of those threads leads somewhere we never followed. Or maybe we couldn't follow it any further. But I don't think it is a definitive no, it wasn't him answer either. So we'll close this segment with a question that's been here since the first time that Avatar hit the true crime thread. Was Papa Roger just another internet phantom? Or was he the killer watching the hunt for himself in real time? And if law enforcement can't or won't answer that definitively, how much of the rest of the we checklist are we supposed to take on blind faith? It's a valid question. What do you think? Again, prove me wrong that that's not him. And the answer can't just be, they said it isn't. It looked like him. Stunningly looked like him. It had inside knowledge no one else had. Police or him? You got other theories? Let me know in the comments on YouTube. And it's not that it was some other killer and he's being framed, because I'm sorry, that shit will just get you banned. Press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts so you don't miss any of our coverage there. And press subscribe to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi on YouTube so you don't miss any of our coverage there. And let us know your thoughts in the comments on YouTube. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now. And don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Starts with a phone call. Ordinary. Domestic. Almost comforting. Placed by a man who had just stepped out of a nightmare he alone created. In a thin gray of an Idaho morning on November 13th of 2022, just hours after four students were slaughtered in their off-campus home, Brian Koberger did not call 911, a lawyer, even a friend, Cleo, the psychic from the 90s, because why not? Is Cleo dead?
Cleo?
I think Cleo died, didn't she?
Yeah, she did, yeah.
There was a doc about her. Anyway. He dialed his mother as Norman Bates, as Brian Koberger does. And once he had that line open, he kept going back to it again and again, like a swimmer clinging to the same rock in a fast, black river. The Times are clinical, almost cold in how precisely they map the mind trying to act normal. 6:13 a.m. First try to mother. And again, I want to pull everybody back for just one second, because remember the old shower photo?
Well, he didn't have his mouth open.
He had one thumbs up. And
like, Mom, look what I did.
And I said forever, this is a nod to so many different things. Psycho number one, American Psycho number two with his clothes, Ted Bundy with the thumbs up. It was a lot. There's a lot of symbolism, I think, that Koberger throws out there because he thinks he's too smart for the room, but it's not hard to figure his shit out. The other one, I mean, Psycho, obviously, the Norman Bates thing and Mother.
Yeah.
And the way he refers to his parents, as we're about to learn, a little creepy.
Oh, no.
Ah, creepy. Little Norman Batesy. So, 6:13 a.m. The first try to mother. No answer. Now, remember, who's calling their parents at 6:13 a.m. unless they're, like, in jail or somebody died or I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why you'd be calling your parents that early in the morning.
You're in the hospital with appendix pain.
Now, I get them calling me at 6:13 in the morning because they're oblivious to anyone outside of themselves in terms of time of day. As they get older, it's like, well, we get up so early and why you're not. I'm not trying to rip on them, but it is funny because as your time shift and you get up earlier, you lose sense of where other people are. But anyway, 6:13 a.m., this is a 20-some-year-old man calling his mom at 6:13 a.m. on a Sunday morning? No answer. 6:14, was it a Sunday? I don't know. I think it was a Sunday morning. I believe it was. If I'm off, I apologize. Anyway, I believe it was part of the weekend. 6:13 a.m., first trend to mother, no answer. 6:14 a.m., call to father. That's how it's listed in the phone. 6:17 a.m., then back to mother. So he's got an impulse. He's got to tell him something. He's got to make him proud.
Yeah.
But in a way, without revealing, he just slaughtered four people. But he's... go ahead.
That's what's really... I'm sitting here thinking, like, what would make me want to call my mom? Like, if I just did something that I was super proud of, especially at that time in the morning. Yeah. Like, Mom, I can't wait to tell you what I did. But I kind of can't tell you what I did.
And it's Saturday morning, it's Sunday morning at 6:17. I'm really proud of what I did, but I can't tell you what I did or who I did.
yeah, but I need to talk to you. We need to have a conversation. I need
Josh
you to
Josh Groban
you.
Was in town.
Hey, you know, I ain't broken.
Back to the mother.
Yes.
This time she picks up. 6:17. And they talk for 36 minutes. He's already home in Pullman by then, back in the apartment where he'll later take a mirror selfie. Just a few minutes later. You know that one? The prosecutors would brand as grotesquely cheerful for a man less than 2 hours removed from carnage. So this gives us a little bit of a perspective on where his mind was at that moment. He was amped up after he did this.
Mm-hmm. Like he had far too many energy drinks.
And he's calling Mom and Dax in a good mood. He needs their affirmation because they're probably the only people in his world who've ever given him some sort of affirmation. Although it does show that in his college career, he did have some. I don't know. But obviously, these two are the ones in a world where nothing matters to Koberger. His parents' opinions do, it seems. His parents, there's something about that. That part is not broken. It's unhealthy to probably a crazy level. But it's not a broken connection there, as he is with everyone else on the planet.
Do you think he was always constantly looking for their approval? Do you think that would be part of it?
I don't think it's as simple as that, but in a simple way of saying it, yes. I think there's a lot more to it, but I think that's probably the simplest way of saying it.
Yeah.
What they said in that call remains private. What matters investigatively and psychologically is the fact of the call, who he wanted to hear, and how soon. Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking to myself at 28. And, you know, I'm not someone who has a ton of friends in the world, honestly. I mean, I was friends with you at that age. But there's always like work friends. I have a very small circle of close friends. I really do. It's not big. So, I mean, I, at 28, was closer with my parents than I am now. And so, I would call them about all sorts of stuff. And you know, sometimes it would be odd hours. Sometimes it'd be like, I don't know. It would be weird shit. You know, you're 28 and you're also kind of dumb because everyone's young and dumb. But
yeah.
But there's, I don't know. I mean, if you're tight with your parents to a certain extent and they're the people who've been there for you for the most part, I get the dynamic, but I feel like, I mean, it's very unhealthy, it seems here to an extent, a very big extent. And as you get to that age, honestly, I think I was more like 23, 24, maybe when that started to slow down. I think by 28, I was pretty much independent. I know. I mean, I was independent at 18. I left the house, but mentally where you're more over here than over there, I think by then I was way over there. But you know,
you were there early though.
I was there very early, a lot of, that's not common though. I mean, a lot of people are not that. So, especially generations now. I mean, they're clinging to mom and dad like way too late. I'm shocked sometimes. I'm like, I've never asked my parents for a dime after I was 18 years old. If I needed it or something, would they have given it? I'm sure they would have, but I never have. They helped pay for a failed marriage. They helped pay for a failed wedding. That was fun. It was a good time by all. Anyway, by 8:03 a.m., he's on the phone with her again. So they just talked. They just talked at 6 something in the morning. And him and his Aspergered up self. And look, I was going to say, you shouldn't say that like that. I can. Because I'm on the spectrum too. So I can understand kind of some of this shit. Not like an I'm going to go kill 4 people sort of way, but kind of the compulsion sort of way, the urge sort of way of what, you know, this would make you feel this way or that way.
Yeah.
So look, I'm not saying it as an asshole. Most people who are, and there's a ton of people there, and this is just how your brain works. You want to share. And I want to be clear in how I'm phrasing this. You want to share your good news with the people you care about. And in Koberger's mind, this was good news. But I don't think he went out and said it. I just think he wanted to emote in some way, shape, or form where he felt like he was getting it out without actually getting the words out.
Yeah.
And that's where he was doing this or why he was doing this. 54 minutes on the phone. Kind of talk that fills a commute, or in this case, a return to the crime scene. Location data shows his phone using towers The cover King Road in Moscow around 9 a.m. Prosecutors later told the court he lingered there roughly 10 minutes. A few minutes after that, another call to his mother, about 9 or 10 minutes again. So this is where he's cruising around, checking out the scene, and on Bluetooth with mom? I don't know. Just as he left the neighborhood where the victim still lay undiscovered. I want to know what the hell was in that conversation, mom.
I mean, what does he say? I'm just tooling around on a Sunday morning. I just thought I'd give you a call. I'm just out driving. I mean,
you already know your son's weird. You already know your son's got something off about him. I don't know if this is parents that are, he needs us. This is all he has. We know that we're all he has. He's, but you're not in any way thinking he could do this. I don't know. And in no way, I want to be clear on this. In no way am I trying to attack mom here or the parents. They're going through hell.
Yeah.
But there is a weird, 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 weird dynamic in this family.
What I want to know is, okay, at this time, they didn't know what had happened where he was.
Yeah.
But in the afternoon, maybe a day later, 2 days later, it hit the news. It hit the news hard. So they hear this and they're like, well, my son is there.
I don't know that they're thinking that way. I mean, have you seen dad?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what to say there. I'm not going to say anything mean, but have you seen dad? Have you seen the video? Have you watched dad interact a little bit? Watch dad interact a little bit and make your own judgments. Okay? In terms of...
Yeah.
I don't know anything. Seems like a nice guy. Seems like a genuinely nice guy that would take the shirt off of his back for anybody.
But dad seems a little off.
Yeah. I don't know what else to say. We know nothing about mom. We saw her come out of the courtroom. We have a picture of her coming out of the court with her bouffant hair, which is like, that I found to be a little odd as well. It's like, we're doing bouffant hair. Okay. As we're coming out at like,
what year is it? Are we at 2025?
I mean, it played more into the Norman Bates vibe of things. The sister looked completely normal. And I hate everybody's judging the sister. She's got the Koberger eyes. And it's like, look, if you're taking all these shots of this woman and you're going to catch her in a weird frame. It's if you're doing 60 frames a second, guess what? One frame's going to look fucking weird.
Yeah.
Guaranteed exactly. Of anybody. So it doesn't make any sense. I mean, she looks like a normal, I don't know. I mean, you're not judging normalcy by appearance. Koberger looks normal by appearance. But I got nothing out of her. I mean, I don't know. She's just trying to live her life. The fact that she's showing up there, I don't know what that says. I don't know that it says support either. I think it might say to her, she needs some closure in her life. And being there to witness this happen is what she needs. I don't know. I can't judge that. And their mere appearance does not, to me, also scream, we're supporting our son.
Right.
I mean, this is a big part of their life they didn't ask for. So they can do as they wish. They are also victims in this.
I was just going to say that, you know, they're different kind of victims, yeah. But their lives are upside down as well.
I mean, unless mom
didn't ask for it.
Unless mom's sitting there on the phone, you know, yeah, kill him. I'm sure she's not. That's insane. I mean, is there probably a level of like coddling or a level of not calling this kid out where he needed to be called out? Or maybe they tried it and it just didn't work, because with a mind like that, if you call it out, it doesn't respond, or it responds simply with violence, or it responds with something completely that you can't deal with. And if you're trying to keep a peace in a family with three kids, you kind of got to do what you got to do at some points in time. So I have a lot of empathy. But look, I am insanely curious about what the hell is going on here, because he's also talked with her an insane amount while he is in jail. And it's maybe it's just a mom giving her son support in a way that none of us can understand. I'm a father. If I knew my daughter did this, I'm sorry, I'm not on the phone with her.
But that's you. I mean, that's, there may be other parents out there that no matter what my child does, I will love them, even if it's the most horrific thing I've ever seen in my life.
Nope. You're a broken person. Unless it's something like this, it's unconditional. Unless you start doing evil shit, and you are not repentant for it, and you're not any sort of sorry, I mean, none of that, the fuck do I need you for at that point?
Well, and this qualifies as evil. This isn't just I robbed a bank or
And that's why, look, I can't say how I would, I mean, and that's me having never experienced like anything like this, and I pray to God I never do. I can't imagine I would. But I can't imagine the Kobergers thought they would either, you know?
Yeah.
And then they're thrown into this hell and they're trying to work this all out. I mean, it's so easy for us to armchair quarterback. And I apologize when I do, because I know I can get into it, but it's like, at the end of the day, you don't know. You don't know.
You really don't.
And these are, no matter how they may have, we can say, if you parented them this way better, or parented them that way better, or this or that, or whatever. Sure. But you know what? They only know what they know. And in the 80s, and the 90s, there's information out there, and I'll tell you what, it changes every fucking decade on how to raise your children. There may have been too much coddling here. I could totally see that. That was a big thing. Children first. That was a huge thing. And it went to such an extreme that you have now adults that can't function in reality because they're first. And they can't handle any sort of conflict. And you mix some sort of mental illness with that, or personality disorder, or whatever it may be with Koberger. And you get this. So, yeah. We all want to find a reason. At the end of the day, it's a very, very broken brain. The juxtaposition is gutting. A son chatting with his mom while just threading past the house, he just turned into a crime scene. He didn't stop there. A 2-minute touch base at 4:05 p.m. Then, as the reality of a homicide started to ripple publicly through Moscow, a long early evening talk with his mother again, lasting 96 minutes in total, more than 3 hours on the phone with her that day. This is just kind of getting weird and unhealthy. I'm sorry. Talk with my mom maybe an hour. Hour two, maybe. Back in those days. Today, I don't know. 35 seconds. No, I'm kidding. No, we usually talk for a while. Me and my parents, we do like FaceTimes. But this, all in the same day, you're starting to rack up like a 6-hour convo with mom and dad.
That has to say that something happened. Something is wrong. Something. I had a pretty horrific, nothing like this, but upheaval. 6 weeks ago, I think my longest conversation with somebody that I needed to talk to was 2 hours.
Sure.
Not six. But my life turned upside down.
I mean, but I guess here's the question, and here's what I'd love to know, is let's look at other phone records with Koberger and his parents, and is this a pattern? Do they talk like this normally? Because maybe they do. We do not know the answer to that question.
You're right.
They may always talk like this. It may be that kind of whatever the hell they got going on dynamic, that this is just how they communicate. If this is a spike in that chain, then you got something that you'd think, or you'd hope maybe they'd be like, the hell's going on here?
Right.
Because it's a deviation in behavior. But if every week it's like, yeah, we're just up and down all the time, you can't tell a deviation because it's always chaos.
Maybe they sit and watch Wheel of Fortune together, you know, and that takes a half hour.
They might. This is one of the cases where Wheel of Fortune isn't in the story in some way, shape, or form. Do you know what I'm talking about? There are two other major cases where the main defendant has been a contestant on Wheel of Fortune with
Pat
Sajak.
Are you kidding me?
In the 90s, late 80s. Donna Adelson and Lori Daybell.
That's right. I knew about Lori. I didn't know about Donna.
Yeah.
Wow.
I was talking with Siobhan about this the other day, and God damn it, our interview we did, the audio didn't record, so we didn't get that. But
did you get video of her?
Were we going to like lip read? what are you talking about? Are you talking about my interview?
Siobhan.
Well, a video, but there's no audio.
Oh, so it's just somebody going.
It's just us talking, but you can't hear. Yeah, so unfortunately, that whole interview just went to shit.
Gotcha.
But anyway, my point was we were talking about this. And I'll reiterate and I said, last question here. What does it say that two of the major stories that we've been covering in the last 365 days involve defendants that both were contestants on Wheel of Fortune? That has to say something, because you don't just like raise your hand and go, I'm going to be on Wheel of Fortune. Okay, well, let's set the date. There's conferences, there's seminars. You got to work your way up this shit. It's insane. It's like, it is a process to become they narrow you down. So the best of the best get on Wheel of Fortune. Because they don't want...
Is it kind of like...
It's like American Idol, but...
Where you just go through this process?
It's like American Idol, basically. But American Idol took their cue from Wheel of Fortune on how to do it. That's, you know, Wheel of Fortune was around way before that. So it's like that. It's just the best contestants. Who's going to be best on the show? Who has personality? Who's smart at this? Who can do this thing? So that's how they get Wheel of Fortune contestants. But at the same point in time... Someone who's going to be very verbose on camera, confident, somewhat intelligent, and the characteristics that you kind of want in a game show character that's going to also be very personable back and forth to other characters, and not necessarily in a good way, but kind of in a I'm better than you sort of way, are narcissists. So... Look, if you are casting a game show, you want to cast narcissists on your show. And it's true. Look at all reality shows. It's all narcissists. Yeah. That's how you make a good television show. That's how they made game shows before they made reality shows. So, Lori Vallow Daybell, Donna Adelson, I can't diagnose her, but, you know, that's what I'm saying. So there's that.
Interesting.
Yeah. Interesting little correlation, isn't it?
And I just randomly said Wheel of Fortune because I was trying to think of what game show pops into my head.
Yeah. Win, lose, or draw.
Jeopardy, but Wheel of Fortune. That would seem like, okay, Brian, as you're driving around, the puzzle is, let's see, we've got I and then a K, and then there's two spaces, and then a D. What would that word be? I killed? I mean, can you imagine?
No. No, do you know what her fucking puzzle was?
No.
Mischief Maker. Donna Adelson. Yeah.
You can't make this shit up.
You can't make this shit up.
And I have no idea. I didn't even know any of this. I knew about Lori because that came up in one of our segments, but I didn't know that about Donna.
I don't know what Lori's puzzle was, but I Mischief Maker.
Wow.
And she solved the puzzle.
Of course she did.
And then Pat goes over and talks to her a little bit, and she talks about the kids. Little Charlie. Little Wendy. And that one that got away, thank God.
Right.
But he's just sitting there going, anyway, back to this case. What we know about the digital trail behind those conversations strips away any benign explanation that his phone died during the murders. It didn't. He turned it off at 2:54 a.m. and powered it back on at 4:48 a.m. A human finger pressing a button on a phone whose battery was full. Investigators called that a pretty awesome moment. Not with joy, but with the relief of clarity. Whatever story the defense might spin about strategizing or wandering in the night, you don't take sky photos with a powered off phone. The data made his intent plain. During the killings, he wanted to be digitally invisible. Afterward, he wanted to be, normal. That normal for him. And it included friends. Forensic review of the device found no text threads with anyone outside of family, no social orbit, no banter with classmates, virtually nothing except calls and a modest family group chat. The parents were saved formally as mother and father, capital M, capital F. When his mother missed a ring, he would ping his father, sometimes even texting in that oddly stiff cadence. Father, why did mother not respond? ?
Are you serious that this is the verbiage that was used? Oh, boy. Oh, who calls their mother and father, mother and father?
Me and Harper do as jokes.
Right, as jokes. But yeah. It's dad or mom or ma. I mean,
yeah.
Mother, father. Yeah, you're not kidding about the Norman Bates.
Well, as they turn into teenagers, it's just...
Father, can I go out tonight? Okay, that's one thing.
No, like if I see my daughter, like, but we do it in jest where it's like, hello, daughter. Hello, father. And it's funny.
Yeah.
This isn't to be funny. This is like someone who is operating in such a mechanical manner, where... It's like a printing press almost. Like, what word would I put in this space to make this sentence make sense? I mean, that's a very, his brain is so, it's so different. It's not understandable by, I think, most sense.
Yeah.
This is not someone who's operating with a full deck at all in terms of how to respond and work within anything else. And I think they always knew it. His learned behavior is how he got by with life for so long, but then his weird urges and shit, I think, took over. It was not a fun, it was a very, very broken brain. And if you're the parents of that, I mean, that's heartbreaking. You don't realize how broken it is until something like this happens, I guess, because you're going to sit there and say, well, you know, he's off, whatever, he's autistic, and, you know, he's on the spectrum somewhere, and that's who he is, you know, but, you know, he's going to college, he's in his master's degree program, he's got skills that are going somewhere, and you're proud of that. He went that far without, as far as we knew, many problems. You know, he had his little stealing phase and heroin phase, but, look, not a lot of people come back from that either, the way that Koberger did. So if you're the parents and you're experiencing that, and this kid came back from heroin addiction and theft and all this shit, and then he's like succeeding, as far as you know, and this happens, that's, you know, like finally, like takeoff. Oh, we got an emergency landing again. Oh, takeoff. Oh, we almost, oh, another one. Oh, I think we're on thin. We're going good. He's going good. And You know, the plane explodes.
Falls out. Yeah.
The plane literally explodes. This all reads like a man who rehearses being a son, as if even his intimacy had to be formatted. And then there's the return, his drive back to the neighborhood around 9 a.m. in offender's impulse that investigators and profilers have seen before. Some go back out of curiosity, some to relive the thrill, some to make sure nothing incriminating was left behind. He did it while mid-conversation with his mother, traveling under the disguise of small talk. Was that cover, comfort, compartmentalization? Maybe all three? Cell data places his phone leaving Pullman around 9 and using resources covering the King Road address from 9:12 to 9:21 a.m. before heading back. And if you're trying to act like it's just a Sunday drive, nothing steadies the hand like a familiar voice in your ear. To understand the pull of that voice, you have to widen the frame on this family. When the headlines were fresh and the national glare was white hot, the Koberger family put out a carefully worded statement. Sorrow for the victims' families, cooperation with law enforcement, and a promise that as a family, we love and support our son and brother. That was not a defense. It was a declaration of bond, the kind that doesn't evaporate when the worst thing in the world happens, for some. For him, the bond ran both ways, backwards to childhood, forward to adulthood. Even at 28, he treated those early morning calls as routine. You can trace the outline of that closeness through the weeks after the murders, mid-December, with suspicion gathering and surveillance teams in the wind. He drove cross-country from Washington State to the Pocono Mountains in Pennsylvania with his father riding shotgun twice. Indiana cops pulled over the two for following too closely. Remember these? We've seen these videos.
Yeah.
Two bland traffic stops now preserved forever on body cam. Father answering small talk in a passenger seat. Again, watch the video. That's dad. Son leaning towards the trooper from behind the wheel. The optics are ordinary. A holiday road trip home. But ordinary is the point. Ordinary is the cloak. This is not to project guilt onto the parents. There's no evidence they knew anything. It's to note the pattern. When life tightened, when he needed a cover, when he wanted to be soothed or simply to appear soothed, he went to them. The forensic expert who examined his device said he sometimes started calling his mother as early as 4 a.m. on normal days. If that's your baseline, then the morning of the murders looks less like a panic response and more like a muscle memory. He did what he always did. He called mother. There's a harsher interpretation, too. Some offenders keep up the chatter with family after the crime, not for comfort, but for narrative control. If anyone later asks where you were, your phone can show a string of wholesome calls. Look, I was home. I was on the phone with my mother all morning talking about biscuits and who is going to be on Rachel Ray today? And did you watch the latest episode of Fixer Upper? Oh, my God. Did you see the way they put the shiplap on that house? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. The problems is that call logs don't travel alone anymore. They bring their friends' cell site records, GPS crumbs, Wi-Fi handshakes. The very call that might have served as a prop for innocence, dubbed as a homing beacon near the scene. And trying to look ordinary, he left a trail that looks anything but. There's also the matter of the mirror. Hours after the killings back in Pullman, he raised his phone and he took a selfie that button-down shirt, earbuds, grin. The prosecutors would later try to fix in the jury's mind as arrogant and unbothered. Well, a potential jury's mind, anyway. It's a small artifact and a mountain of evidence, but it sits uneasily beside those calls. If he felt shame, it didn't leak into the lens. If he felt fear, it didn't ghost his voice long enough to keep him off the phone with his mother. What it does suggest is a man capable of flipping the switch from ferocity to performative normalcy without a visible tremor. By the time the legal machinery completed its long turn, change of venue, pretrial fights, a late plea to avoid death, his family's presence never quite left the frame. His mother and sister came to court. They shook and wept as sentence was passed. He didn't look back. The same man who could not start that November Sunday without talking to his mother left the courtroom in Boise without acknowledging her. If the morning phone calls were a bid to keep life together, the final silence was an admission that it had shattered. So what do those calls really say about the relationship? Start with attachment, not the warm, balanced kind that lets adult children separate and return as equals, but the other kind, the one that looks like dependence dressed up as ritual. The labeling of mother and father and early hour habits and ping-ponging between both parents. If one didn't answer, these are the fingerprints of a grown man who either couldn't or wouldn't build a circle beyond the family home base. When his mother didn't pick up at 6:13 a.m., his message to his father landed like a child testing doors in a dark house. Is anyone awake? Can we get breakfast? Where is she? Why isn't she answering me? Layer it in normalization. After an extreme act, human beings often grope for the familiar. Coffee, a shower, a voice that knows you. Calling your mother after you commit a quadruple homicide is not the same as calling her after a tough exam or a night shift. But the brain can abuse the same pathway. Talk to mom. Hear her cadence, borrow her normal to paper over your chaos. And when he rolled past King Road on the 8:03 a.m. call, he could have been balancing two realities at once. The illicit return to a scene only he knew was a tomb, and the banal soundtrack of an adult son morning phone call. Compartmentalization isn't just a trait in textbooks. It's a thing you can watch if you're looking in the right places. Add some calculation, and it's difficult to ignore that he turned his phone off before the killings. It's not impulsive, it's planned. And he turned the same phone into a machine of routine. Minutes later, calls to mother. Long talk at breakfast time, afternoon check-ins, evening marathon. It's also planned in a different way. Creates noise. It plants timestamps that look domestic. But the same digital universe that helps spin the routine also pins it down. The probable cause affidavit, dry as a ledger, lists the 9:12 to 9:21 a.m. coverage near King Road as clearly as a receipt. And if those calls were theater, the cell site data was a stagehand yanking up the curtain mid-scene. And consider identity. People who live heavily inside their heads, who curate a self for the outside world, will sometimes perform good son as a role. It's not that the love isn't real, it's that the role serves the function. The cross-country drive with dad becomes an alibi of presence. The morning calls become proof of stability. The family statement becomes a shield of respectability. We support him. We pray for the victims. We trust the process. Each brick is understandable. Together, they build a facade thick enough to muffle what's behind it. There's empathy due here. and it belongs to the parents. To love your child is not a crime. To pick up your phone at dawn is not complicity. The mother's presence at sentencing, shuddering, head in hands, reads like a woman drowning in two truths: the son she raised and the man the evidence revealed. If there is a cruelty specific to this kind of case, it is that the same closeness that once looked like family and family strength can, in hindsight, look like the rope he kept pulling at to steady himself after violence. That's not on her, it's on him. What remains then is the shape of a relationship through a keyhole of digital forensics, a man who meticulously hid his signal during the window of the murders, then flooded the line to his mother like a dam breaking, his son who, when his worst thing he'd ever done was still warm, reached not for confession, but for contact, a family that said they would love and support him even as they prayed daily for the children he took. Those truths can live in the same sentence without canceling each other out. They have to. If you're looking for a meaning in those calls, it may be this. He toggled between stealth and normalcy with disturbing ease, invisible. While the crime was in progress, ordinary as soon as it was over. And that ordinary traveled on a family line, one that had probably long comforted him. And yet, when accountability arrived, when the judge read out four consecutive life sentences and the gallery choked in grief, ordinary finally failed him. He left without a word to the same mother whose voice he'd need most on the morning he killed. The line went dead. The rock in the river was out of reach. And nothing in the call log could change who he was by then. For all the unanswered questions in the case, the calls answered one. Who he chose when the mask had to be put back on over 3 hours with his mother on the day of the murders, a detour past the scene, whilst on the line, a phone that went dark at 2:54 a.m., then lit up with mother at 6:17, threads of routine woven through a morning that was anything but. In the end, that's the story of his relationship with his parents. As the evidence shows it, constant formal relied upon and ultimately powerless to stop when he already was. If there's a final image to hold, make it this. Two hands on a steering wheel, a voice through a speaker from a house three time zones away, and a street in Moscow, Idaho, rolling past the window like any other Sunday. On one side of the glass is the quiet voice of a mother, a tether to the simple and familiar. On the other is the house he'd turned into a tomb. Between them, a man who thought he could live both realities at once. The records say what his words don't. The calls, those small domestic calls, are the map. Tell me what you think in the comments section. On YouTube. And tell me what you think, Stacey. Right here. Right now. As we're sitting here. And you have a slide behind you. Do you ever go down that slide in the background by the chance?
It is. Yeah. Because when you don't want to take the stairs, you can just take the slide.
It looks fun. I got to put that in my house, actually.
I'm surprised you don't have one.
I'm working on a duck pin bowling alley right now.
Well, you have your priorities. Back to Koberger. Ignoring my slide, my $1 million slide. This from the woman who was concerned that my showers were taking too long.
Yes. Anyway, yes. Back to Koberger.
Anywho, I need to know, and I said this to you before we started recording, I need to know more about this family. Yeah. It's none of our business, but I need to know more. Just as a curious citizen. Yeah. I want to know. First of all, did they know that Brian was capable of such activity? Did they know that, you know, because we all have family members where you just kind of look at them at Thanksgiving and go, some shit's going to go down at some point with this person.
I mean, well, how do you know that anyone is capable of this unless they've actually done it, you know? I mean, I don't think that's even like a real question. I mean, unless they're like sitting there spouting it off like, I'm going to go kill all these college girls. I mean, if he's doing that, then yes, you know your son's capable of it. I don't think he was doing that, though.
But I wonder what the signs were, because I don't think somebody just wakes up and goes
quick to anger, hate towards women, really awkwardness, seemingly have no clue how to interact with other people, especially women, and very quick to anger when he's rejected. I can guarantee there's probably 500 people on this earth who saw him exhibit all of those behaviors at one point or another or collectively.
Did his sister?
Yes, I'm sure they did. But just because you witness it doesn't mean you can do anything about it. I've worked with people like that. I'm sure you probably have too. Yeah. And there's nothing you can do about it. It's not like, well, this person's probably going to end up like killing somebody at some point or some sort of horrible domestic violence towards a female, just judging by these traits, but you can't go and arrest them pre-crime. So I'm guessing there's a lot of people who thought, when they found out Koberger did this, that knew him, were like, yeah, saw that one coming.
Yeah.
I mean, it's horrible to say, but it's probably true. And what do you do? I mean, if that's your kid, I mean, I think they were trying to do everything they knew they possibly could do to try and support their kid. And maybe it was too fluff, maybe it was too coddled, maybe it was too this, maybe it was too that. Who the hell knows? At the end of the day, I think his mind was just broken. I don't think there was anything anyone could do, quite honestly, that was going to change it.
Yeah.
I think maybe they allowed him to live 28 years of life with some sort of fluff until it finally broke. And had they not given him that fluff to keep himself moving forward, probably would have killed somebody at 18.
And again, that's what I want to know. Were there any close calls? Were there those moments of he's in a outrageous mood and it, you know, he's violent, he's doing all these things. Did they see something before where they just didn't know how to handle him because he was just off the rails?
Yeah.
You know,
I'm sure there were plenty of signs. I'm sure there's plenty of signs they can all look back on and go, yeah, I get it now. But none of them are going to be like, oh, if I just brought that to the police. Because none of them could. You can't do anything. No. There's nothing they could have got. And look, I mean, trying to steer him this way, that way, nobody's going to try and steer their kids to go be a homicidal maniac.
No.
So however they steered him, it strengthened his screwed up beliefs or it weakened them. I don't know that they had that much of an influence either way. I think his brain was going to do what it was going to do. I think they tried their damnedest. I do feel bad for them. I don't think they're operating the Bates Motel. Was there maybe too close of a relationship there? Maybe, but with the mom and son. And I'm not saying anything weird like sexual or anything like that. I don't think that by any means. But was this like too coddling, too, you know, affirming to Brian's fucked up thinking? I don't know. At the end of the day, what do you do when you're the parent in that situation? Unless they're telling you, I'm going to go butcher up college kids, which I'm sure he's not doing. You're a parent. You're trying to be there for your kid, and you just probably don't know just how dark this kid is because he's never truly emoted it. And people like this, they compartmentalize things so deep and so far back that it's not surprising it didn't reach the surface and these parents were just as shocked.
Yeah.
That's how I feel. I mean, it's a weird family. It is. I mean, it's a weird dynamics, but weird doesn't mean bad. It's just, I don't know. Seems like
different than the norm.
Seems like an odd group of folks. And again, and I'm not saying that in a bad way. It's just odd group of folks. I don't know. I have no idea. But just from what I've observed, they just seem, I don't know. I don't know. And that's the thing. But in no way am I thinking that they in any way had anything to do with encouraging him to do something like this or enabling it or finding out he did it and covering it up. I think he used them for fuel, just as monsters do. They tap into other people. Wow. And they use them for what will fill
them up. Yeah, there's a lot
to
learn about this family.
Yeah. And I think that that's what it was. And yeah, it's got to be hell for them. Anyway, tell me what you think in the comment section. If you're not already there on YouTube, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and find us there. Or you can also find us wherever you get podcasts. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi there to find us as well. All right. We appreciate all of that and your comments. Press subscribe. Until next time, for Stacy and myself, we will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.